Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com. Hi, this is Cale Clark. Welcome back to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. You know, we get a lot of mail here at The Faith Explained, and you can email us too. The address is faith@relevantradio.com. And I got a great question from Liam, who wrote in to ask, "Hi, Cale, could you talk about some easily misunderstood and often misinterpreted Bible verses on The Faith Explained program?" Liam, I would be glad to. There are so many of them. Where do we start? I'd like to do this on a regular basis. I think it's a great, great suggestion. So let's start today. And by the way, if you have a question, a topic that you'd like us to cover, why not email me once again at faith@relevantradio.com. Okay, so let's look at the verse that I want to talk about today that's often ripped out of its context, misinterpreted, misunderstood. And it's from the book of Revelation. Is heaven really all about streets of gold and pearly gates? Well, in Revelation chapter 21, verse 21, we read this. The 12 gates of the city were 12 pearls. Each single gate was made from one pearl. And the street of the city was pure gold, like transparent glass. And by the way, speaking of the book of Revelation, our entire Revelation series that we did here on The Faith Explained is now back online in its entirety. We are getting emails, speaking of emails, from all over the world, people asking, can I access all these episodes again? Well, they are now all back up there. Our Revelation series is there. So simply go to relevantradio.com, click on where it says our shows, find The Faith Explained, and you should be able to find the Revelation series, the Genesis series, and some of the other ones that we've done. We're working on getting all of the series back up there on the website for you to enjoy time and time again and share them with a friend. So this verse from Revelation, we obviously covered that in the series, so you're going to want to consult that for a little bit more depth, but really this is all about the New Jerusalem. And the way it's described at the end of Revelation in chapter 21, generally a lot of people think that it's describing heaven. And this is where the saints are going to spend all of eternity. There are all kinds of jewels, the pearly gates, the famous pearly gates, the streets of gold. All of us have at some point heard this kind of language. What does it really mean? Well, a lot of people think this is describing heaven. And I'm here to tell you, it's not describing heaven at all. Not at all. This is not at all talking about heaven. Now, that might surprise you. Hang on here. These pearly gates, the streets of gold, what is it all about then? Well, the big flaw in this interpretation, and this is always the case with scripture that's misinterpreted, is it's taken out of context. And there's a very famous saying that you might have heard before in a sermon or homily, a text, a biblical text, taken out of context becomes a pretext for a proof text. Now, that's another way of saying, it's kind of a fancy way of saying that I can make the Bible say whatever I want it to by taking texts or cutting them out, as it were, out of the surrounding paragraphs, the larger book that's in question, the bigger argument. Let's look at how this passage actually starts. Now, we need to go back closer to the beginning of chapter 21. And I think the whole chapter is really worth going over, but it says this. One of the seven angels who had the seven bowls full of the seven final plagues came and spoke with me, saying, "Come here, I will show you the bride, the wife of the Lamb." And he carried me away in the spirit to a great and high mountain and showed me the holy city, Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, having the glory of God. Her brilliance was like a very costly stone, like a stone of crystal clear jasper. And that's Revelation chapter 21, verses 9 to 11. And the biblical scholar Jason Staples, he wrote a blog post about this very question some years ago. And he says this, look, it's pretty hard to imagine this passage being any clearer in what it's trying to describe to us. What's it all about? The bride, the wife of the Lamb. Now, who's the Lamb? Jesus Christ, of course. This is not describing heaven. It's not even describing a place, as it were. It's a metaphorical description. It's a symbolic description, as it were, of the bride of Christ, the church. And, you know, who is Jesus married to? Not Mary Magdalene. I've debunked that misunderstanding on many occasions. The bride of Christ, of course, is the church, the ecclesia, the called out ones. Now, why is the church described as having a wall, a very high wall? And you can see this in verse 12 of Revelation 21. Well, that's because you've got to enter. You can't climb the wall to get into the church. You've got to enter through the proper way. That is, through the gates. There are 12 gates. And the wall also is a good defense mechanism as well. But there are 12 gates. And you can read about this in Revelation 21, verse 12, where it says this. At the 12, it had a great high wall with 12 gates, and at the gates, 12 angels, and on the gates, the names of the 12 tribes of the sons of Israel were inscribed. And it goes on to say in verse 13, on the east, 3 gates, on the north, 3 gates, on the south, 3 gates, and on the west, 3 gates. And on the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and on them the 12 names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So we see here that we have the 12 tribes of Israel and the 12 original apostles. Now, obviously, this is trying to imply that the church is the new Israel. And when Jesus named 12 apostles, it was very clear to everyone around him what exactly he was doing. He was saying, I'm restarting Israel. I'm restarting the people of God. That's something only God had the authority to do. So it's a great clue as to the identity of Jesus himself. Now, it's interesting to note that the gates of the city are on all four sides. Why is that? Because the church is to come from the whole earth. And even the 12 foundation stones here, in verse 14, it says, represent the 12 apostles. So what about the streets of gold? What about these precious stones? All of this really is about the people of God, the virtues of the people of God. And Jason Staples pulls a lot of verses from the Old and New Testament that make this really obvious. Let's take a look at, first of all, some of the wisdom literature in the Old Testament. Let's look at the book of Proverbs here. In Proverbs 10:20, it says, the tongue of the righteous is like choice silver. Okay. Proverbs 25:11 says, like apples of gold in settings of silver is a word rightly spoken. So again, these precious objects. In Proverbs 20:15, it says, there is gold and many jewels and an abundance of utensils, the lips of knowledge. Okay. Proverbs 25:12 says, an earring of gold and an ornament of gold is a wise judge to a listening ear. Okay, so if you've got wisdom in judgment, if you've got a listening ear, it's like an earring of gold and an ornament of gold. In Proverbs 31:10, of course, that famous passage on the wonderful wife, it says, who can find an excellent wife far better than jewels? Okay, so you get the point. This is really about virtuous living. It's being compared to fine jewels and gold. And then again, we look at the another Old Testament book, the Song of Songs, or the Song of Solomon. And of course, it's a great ode to love in some ways. It says, his head is like gold, pure gold. His locks are like clusters of dates and black as a raven. His hands are rods of gold set with beryl. His abdomen is carved ivory, inlaid with sapphires. It's not a description of me, as much as you might think it is, no. It goes on to say, his legs are pillars of alabaster set on pedestals of pure gold. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. Okay, so there's another example of that. Now let's look at the New Testament. Let's look at 1 Corinthians chapter 3. This is St. Paul writing here. And this makes it maybe even more clear that the church, the people of God, is in view. Paul writes, "According to the grace of God, which was given to me, like a wise architect, I laid a foundation. Another is building on it. But let each pay attention to how he builds on it. For no person can lay a foundation other than the one which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. But if someone builds on the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each person's work will be exposed. For the day will show it, since it is to be revealed with fire. And the fire itself will test the quality of each one's work. Do you not realize that you are a temple of God and that the Spirit of God dwells in you?" And that's for 1 Corinthians chapter 3. It's this idea of building on the foundation laid by Jesus Christ with gold, silver, and precious stones. And of course, that's a reference to the building up of the church. Let's look at another passage that it's also from the Old Testament, and it's often overlooked, and Staples brings it up. It's from the book of Isaiah, Isaiah chapter 49, and this is really all about the fact that God has not forgotten about his people Israel. He's not forgotten about Zion. And he actually says, believe it or not, the enemies of the people of God, the Gentiles, will become a part of Israel. How is that going to happen? Well, Isaiah says that she is going to put them on. And obviously the people of God have always been referred to as a bride, as a she, and that's true of the church as well. She will put them on like jewels and bind them on like a bride, the Gentiles. It's amazing. Check out this passage from Isaiah chapter 49, starting at verse 14. But Zion said, "The Lord has forsaken me, and the Lord has forgotten me. Can a woman forget her nursing child and have no compassion on the son of her womb? Even these may forget, but I will not forget you. See, I have inscribed you on the palms of my hands. Your walls are continually before me. Your builders hurry. Your destroyers and devastators will depart from you. Lift up your eyes and look around. All of them gather together. They come to you. As I live, declares the Lord, you will surely put on all of your destroyers and devastators as jewels and bind them on as a bride." So what's he saying here? The new Jerusalem that we read about in Revelation, that's exactly the people of God. It's not a place. It's not heaven, what we might call heaven. It's not the new heaven and the new earth as is promised to us in the book of Revelation. What that's going to be like, I don't know. I haven't gotten there yet. Lord willing, I'll be able to experience that along with you. This is the future home of the saints, but that's not what's in view here. This new Jerusalem descending from heaven is not heaven. First of all, it comes from heaven, descending down. So it's not heaven itself. And this really matters when it comes to interpretation of this verse. And what does it mean to talk about the pearly gates, the streets of gold? You're listening to The Faith Explained on Relevant Radio. I'm your host, K.O. Clark. Well, Jason Staples says, look, the reason why people misinterpret this passage is causing a lot of issues. Now, number one, it's kind of a very materialistic way of looking at heaven, this idea of pearly gates, all these fine jewels, streets of gold. Now, clearly, anything of monetary value is of no use in heaven anyways. It really doesn't to make any difference. It doesn't help in any way. We won't have to worry about that stuff. But it misses the point. It misses the point of this passage in Revelation. It's really supposed to be about the goodness of the people of God, the virtues of the people of God, how Christ enables us to shine from within. It's amazing. The people of God are the jewels of righteousness. The righteousness flows through them. That is worth far more than earthly gold. And the real big prize here, what we're shooting for when we read Revelation, we want to be a part of this, this idea that the presence of God is in the midst of his people. The Lamb is the light of the city of God. It's from within, God living within. And then, of course, as this passage in Isaiah 49, which I just read to you, says, when Israel is restored completely, guess what? The Gentiles are going to be incorporated in. And the bride of God is going to put them on like jewels and fine rubies. This is the Gentiles being incorporated into the church, the Catholic Church. The word Catholic means universal. It's for all peoples, in all times, in all places. It's universal. I love this. This is really what Christianity is all about. And so it's not about some sort of an opulent heaven or anything like that, although I'm sure it's far beyond anything we could possibly compare it to. And this is kind of the point here. This is symbolic language. And one way that you can interpret the very first verse of Revelation is as follows. It could be translated as the revelation of Jesus Christ, which he made known by symbolism to his servant John. Now, in your English translation, it usually doesn't get translated like that. It usually says something like this. A lot of English Bibles, and here is the Revised Standard Version, Second Catholic Edition, the revelation of Jesus Christ, the apocalypsis in Greek of Jesus Christ, that's where you get the word apocalypse from, the revelation of Jesus Christ, which God gave him to show to his servants what must soon take place. Well, that actually can be translated as follows, which he made known by symbolism to his servant John, to tell him what must soon take place. And so this is symbolic language. This is what apocalyptic literature is all about. Like the great description of Christ at the beginning of the book. I've seen paintings of this done where they try to meld all these images together. Jesus literally has a sword hanging out of his mouth. His tongue is like a sharp two-edged sword, it says. His eyes are like blazing fire. And he's portrayed as having almost like heat vision, like Superman. But it's symbolic. It's imagery. And if you don't get what the images mean, you'll never understand the book. Now, there are some books in the New Testament that do convey history, such as the letters of Paul, such as the Gospels, historical biography, and the Greco-Roman type of biography that was very common in that day. There are historical books in the Old Testament as well. But Revelation is a different animal. It's an apocalypse. So you've got to understand what the symbols mean. And that's really what it means when it talks about the pearly gates, the streets of gold. It's not heaven. It's a description of the people of God and their qualities, just like fine gold, their character, God shining through. Amazing. So that's what it's really all about. And it's often not translated that way in your English Bible. It can be a bit of a clunky translation, but it really is symbolism here. And that's what it's all about. I want to talk now about the saint of the day. Today is the feast day of Saint Polycarp of Smyrna. And if you've never read the Fathers of the Church, especially the Apostolic Fathers of the Church, you're really missing out. As one writer has called them, the most dangerous men in Christianity, because in their writings we find out what the early church was really all about. And why do I say that? Well, because when you read the writings of the New Testament, it's not a how-to-do-church manual. St. Paul is writing to people who are already believers. He's not necessarily writing to evangelize. These people are already in the church. They already kind of knew how everything worked. And he's trying to remind them of certain truths, ways that they've gone off track. But when we read the Apostolic Fathers of the Church, we often see these guys trying to explain. These are people who took over the leadership of the church, men who took over after the death of the apostles. Those are the Apostolic Fathers, and the Fathers of the Church in general usually go up to about the 6th century. So when we look at the writings of Clement of Rome, Ignatius of Antioch, these are the Apostolic Fathers, Polycarp of Smyrna, very crucial. And then later on we have Justin Martyr, St. Irenaeus, writers like Tertullian and Origen, Saint Cyprian of Carthage, Athanasius, just such richness there. And I think we should all dive into that as much as we possibly can. But I want to talk about Polycarp because it's his feast day today. He was born about the year 69 AD in the first century, and he was martyred in the year 155. Now, when he was young, he actually heard the preaching of the Apostle John himself, just like Ignatius of Antioch, and those two men knew each other very well. John the Apostle was probably a teenager when he started following Jesus. He was the only one of the 12 who wasn't martyred, and he certainly was persecuted, and he lived into a very, very ripe old age. And so Polycarp, when he was young, he became the disciple of St. John. And Ignatius of Antioch wrote these very famous seven letters to seven churches on the way to his martyrdom, his own martyrdom, in the Roman Colosseum in either the year 107 AD or maybe 110 AD, somewhere in there. He also wrote a letter, Ignatius did, to Polycarp. And in that letter, Ignatius urged Polycarp, "Give heed to the bishop so that God may give heed to you." Listen to the bishop so that God will listen to you. It's a great line. Now, Polycarp himself wound up becoming a bishop, the Bishop of Smyrna. And that's a city that's mentioned in ancient Christianity. It's mentioned in the book of Revelation, which we were talking about earlier. St. John, in Revelation chapter 2, verse 11, talks about the angel of the church in Smyrna. Now, we're not 100% sure about what that means, but one interpretation is that he's speaking to the bishop of that particular church. That's who the angel, quote-unquote, is. Maybe, maybe not. But here's what it says. In writing to Smyrna, John says, "Be faithful unto death, and I will give you the crown of life." And that's exactly what happened to Polycarp of Smyrna. In about the year 155 AD, he was martyred. And I'm going to just read to you really quickly some excerpts from a letter that's really the only surviving letter that we have from Polycarp. And I'm also going to give you a couple of quotes from the Martyrdom of Polycarp, which is the oldest account that we have in the church of a martyrdom. It's quite powerful. It's quite inspiring. So this is a little bit from the second letter of Polycarp to the Philippians, just as St. Paul wrote to the Philippian church. Guess what? So did Polycarp. So let me just read to you. Now, we don't have the first letter. It hasn't been found, but we do have his second letter to the Philippians, St. Polycarp of Smyrna. And he wrote this at about 135 AD, so somewhat of the first section of the second century. And he's writing to priests as well as lay people. He says, "Let the presbyters," or the priests, "be compassionate and merciful to all, bringing back those that wander, visiting all the sick, and not neglecting the widow, the orphan, or the poor, but always providing for that which is becoming in the sight of God and man, abstaining from all wrath, respect of persons." Now, he doesn't mean don't respect anybody. He means don't give in to human respect. Don't treat people differently because of their social status. Got to tell the truth to everybody. "Abstaining from unjust judgment, keeping far off from all covetousness, not quickly crediting an evil report against anyone." That's really important. Not quickly believing an evil report about anybody. There's so much gossip in the church, and that was no less true in the first century. People are people. It was like that way in the beginning as well. "Don't be severe in judgment," Polycarp says, "knowing that we are all under a debt of sin. If then we entreat the Lord to forgive us, we ought also ourselves to forgive. For we are before the eyes of our Lord and God, and we must appear at the judgment seat of Christ, and must everyone give an account of himself. Let us then serve him in fear, with all reverence, even as he himself has commanded us, and the apostles who preach the gospel unto us, the prophets who proclaim beforehand the coming of the Lord, have alike taught us. Be zealous in the pursuit of that which is good, keeping ourselves from any causes of offense, from false brethren, and from those who in hypocrisy bear the name of the Lord, and draw away vain men into error." So he also talks about in this letter the Antichrist. He says, whoever does not confess that Jesus Christ has come in the flesh is Antichrist. And he's echoing there the words of his mentor, John the Apostle, in his letters. He says, whoever does not confess the testimony of the cross is of the devil, and whoever perverts the oracles of the Lord or the teachings of the Lord to his own lusts and says that there is neither a resurrection nor a judgment, he is the firstborn of Satan. Wow, anybody who says that is the firstborn of Satan. So some really strong teaching from St. Polycarp. Now, let me share with you just in closing from the document that's known as the Martyrdom of St. Polycarp. And he was dragged into the arena and he was burned at the stake. It says, when the Roman proconsul urged him and said, take the oath to the emperor as God and I will release you, revile Christ. All he had to do was say that Caesar was Lord and Jesus was not, but Polycarp wouldn't do it. Polycarp answered, 86 years have I served him, and he has never done me wrong. How then should I blaspheme my king who has saved me? Wow, that's incredible. I think we can all say the same, no matter how old we are, how young we are. Christ has never done us wrong. And so here's what happened when he was killed. It says, those who were appointed for the purpose kindled the fire, and as the flame blazed forth in great fury, we, to whom it was given to witness it, beheld a great miracle. For the fire, shaping itself into the form of an arch, like the sail of a ship when filled with the wind, encompassed as by a circle the body of the martyr. And he appeared within, not like flesh which is burnt, but as bread that is baked, or as gold and silver glowing in a furnace. Moreover, we perceived such a sweet odor, as if frankincense or some such precious spices had been smoking there. Wow. So maybe some hyperbolic language for sure, but this idea that when Polycarp was being burned at the stake, they didn't smell rotting flesh. They smelled something like baking bread, and he had the appearance of gold and silver glowing in a furnace. And certainly that purifying, that last purification of martyrdom was unbelievable. So I encourage you guys to read that, The Martyrdom of St. Polycarp. You can find it on the internet. He's a really inspiring saint. It's his feast day today. I'm Cale Clark. Thanks for listening to The Faith Explained today on Relevant Radio. If you have a question, once again, or something that you'd like us to answer, please email us, faith@relevantradio.com. It's The Faith Explained, class after mass, as we like to say. Share it with a friend, and I'll see you in the next episode. God bless you.